Managers aren't paid to do work. They're paid to get results. Far too many managers foolishly and compulsively take whatever work is dumped on their desk without thinking through the key question. Will this task contribute to the accomplishment of a key result area? In the last century, Bill Pareto, an Italian economist, enunciated what became known as the Pareto Principle. Pareto said that 80% of a manager's results come from 20% of his work. This 20% of the work that produces 80% of the results, Pareto called the vital few. In our modern management parlance, these are described as the key results areas, or KRAs. The problem for most managers is that 80% of their time is eaten away by the trivial many. The junk and trash, the routine, mundane nonsense that organizations are perpetually churning out. These could be everything from government requirements to a manager's vocational hobbies. And what does the manager get for spending 80% of his time on the trivial many? Well, perhaps only 20% of the total results. So there's an inverse relationship between the time we spend and the kind of results we get. And the reason for that is the nature of the kind of work that we're doing. Suppose we spend 80% of our time, 80% of our meetings, 80% of our memo reading and writing, 80% of our discussions on things that are of relatively little value. Even if we do these things with great affection, even if we do them beautifully, even if we dot all the I's and cross all the T's, we're going to get relatively little, perhaps only 20%, of our results from all this work. There's nothing so tragic as seeing a manager do with great perfection that which should not be done at all. Yet when we have the time, when we can make the time, when we push back the flood of all the nonsense that the organization and the people around us are asking us to do, when we spend that one day a week or 2 hours out of every eight, when we devote 20% of our time to those key results areas, why, then we get tremendous results, perhaps 80% of our results. This 80% versus the 20% phenomenon applies to both effective and ineffective managers. What makes for an effective manager is that they recognize the time trap that exists in the 80%, and so they try to spend a little less time in that area and a little more time working on the vital few tasks. No manager, not the most effective manager in the world, spends 100% of his time working on the key result areas. Studies show that the effective manager, on average, spends only 5 or 10% more of his time on the key results areas than his ineffective counterpart. But because of the 4-to-1 power ratio involved in the Pareto principle, 5% more time on the vital tasks gets you 20% more results. 10% more time spent on key results areas gets you 40% more results. And so the difference between effective winning performances and ineffective losing performances is that the effective manager spends a little more time on the right targets. And secondly, he clearly identifies what those targets are. Let me state that again. The difference between an effective manager and an ineffective one is that the former spends more time on KRA work and gets that time by reducing the pile of trivial trash. And the reason this simple strategy works is because of the high degree of leverage in the Pareto principle. One of the practical approaches that effective managers use is called work gating, G-A-T-I-N-G. Work gating suggests that each manager should serve as a gate, allowing some work into his unit or onto her to-do list, and gating out other tasks which shouldn't be done. Work gating consists of a series of three questions that should be asked in sequence regarding each piece of work that comes to a manager's attention. In order to make sure that you're on track in deciding what work you'll spend time on, you might want to use this series of questions and actions yourself. The first question in work gating is this piece of work a key result area? The KRA focus that effective managers have always makes this the first question. Obviously, if it's KRA work, we want to do it. So as you pick up that first piece of paper, you ask the first question. Is this going to affect one or more of my key result areas? Will it affect customer satisfaction, economic performance, productivity, quality, innovation, people growth, or organization climate? If the answer is yes, it would make a significant contribution to one or more of these KRAs, then that is work that should be done. If, on the other hand, the answer to the first question is no, this is not a KRA, then that piece of work from here on out should be considered suspect. If it's clearly not a KRA, then it's definitely one of the trivial trash items and should be handled as if it is dangerous. Because it is. It's dangerous to your career. It's going to sandbag other productive work. There's a lot of risk associated with carrying out this kind of work. This kind of work may produce very little for you. And so you should ask the second question. If this is not KRA work, do I, as the manager, have to do it? Do I have to do it? Frankly, if it isn't KRA work, I don't want to do it. But if the answer is yes, you still have to do it, the government requires it, or your boss has told you to do it, or another department needs this help, then you'll go ahead and do it. The key here is to avoid putting this work before your KRAs. Do it, but do it only after the KRAs have been attended to, and when you do it, give it minimal attention. Do it as quickly, as easily as you can. Don't worry that it's not totally perfect. If you can get by with a little lower standard of performance on it, whereas with KRA work you have only one standard, and that's the standard of excellence. But on trivial trash, you don't have to do that excellently. Don't spend any more time or effort on this than is required. Just do it after your other, more important work. So as you start each day, do something that contributes to one of your KRAs first, and then do this piece of non-KRA work that you have to do later. On the other hand, if the answer to the question, do I have to do it, is no, then it's time to ask the third question. Should it be done by anybody? It's been said that amateurs in management delegate nothing. Average managers delegate everything. But effective managers don't delegate work that isn't worth being done by anybody. So if a piece of work, as you pick it up, is not a KRA, and you yourself don't have to do it, don't just delegate that to someone, but instead ask the third question. Should it be done at all by anybody? If the answer is yes, it should be done, then it's proper to delegate a piece of non-KRA work that is apparently worth doing, but it's not worth your time in doing it. Now, some of these tasks that will be delegated are going to be enriching and job-stretching. So even if the work itself isn't related to a KRA, if it strengthens a staff member, then that is accomplishing one of your KRAs, which is people growth. But as is often the case, this delegated work is sometimes not really teaching people anything. They're not learning anything from it. They're not really gaining any skills. And so it can have a possible negative motivational impact. If it has to be delegated, if it has to be done, but not by you, beware of who does what and how often they do it. Since some of these delegated tasks will have a negative impact, and others will have a positive motivational impact, skillful managers try to make sure that there's a mix in the blend of tasks that are delegated. You simply can't expect a lot of enthusiasm for a piece of scut work. On the other hand, if the answer to the third question, should it be done by anybody, is no, then the only proper course of action is to trash that piece of work, or better yet, stop it from coming in the future. Effective managers buy everybody in the unit a bigger wastebasket, and they teach everybody in the unit how to use this sequence of three questions to sort out their KRAs from all the other junk. So when possible, get off of mailing lists, discontinue junk mail, and get uninvited to committee meetings. And better yet than trashing work, become so organized that you don't even have to go to the dumper. Once you have clearly separated in your mind the importance of focusing on the vital KRAs, and you're working effectively with the gating procedure to minimize the impact of the trivial tasks, you'll need to sharpen up your delegation skills to make those non-KRA tasks get accomplished more effectively. Good delegation skills are a key component of managerial success. Delegation literally makes a manager's associate his legate, his legal agent. The agent can act only under the terms of his commission on behalf of the manager. Some people have confused the issue by saying that responsibility cannot be delegated. What is delegated is responsibility and authority to act. What cannot be delegated is the ultimate accountability of the manager. What are some of the conditions that make for effective delegation? After you decide to assign a task to an associate, the following elements will help you assure satisfactory completion. First, ask, who is my pro? Who would benefit in terms of developmental stretch? This will help target the appropriate agent. Always ask, is there anybody who can do this, who should do this, or who could be trained to do this? Second, have a clear dialogue and discussion about what is expected. Outline the standards of performance you're going to use to judge the results. Say when you want it, what the priority is in terms of other work the associate is doing, and what level of authority is involved. Also establish interim dates of review if that's necessary. What dollar level of decision-making are you willing to entrust to others? Can they make a $5 or a $50,000 decision without having to check with you first? It may also be necessary to establish other control limits, such as policy. Establish all that you can to let the associate know the arena that he or she is operating in, and identify the specific kinds of information you want as feedback and the report format you want. Remember the principle of exception reporting. You only need to see information that is a significant positive or negative deviation from the agreed-upon standard of performance. Step 3 in effective delegation is to always ask for commitment. Never assume that you've got it. And fourth, provide training support if this is a new practice area for the person to whom you're delegating. Fifth, be prepared to reward excellence. The basis of motivation is having the opportunity to do meaningful work and then getting recognition following that achievement. Think through now how you'll recognize good performance for each assignment. And sixth, be prepared to give full support in the clinches. At Hewlett-Packard, the saying is, if you can't make a mistake, you can't make anything. Don't be an amateur in management by choking off delegation simply because the assignee couldn't produce perfection. Be ready to stand by them, and be ready to stand by them in a mistake. Seventh, do not accept upward delegation. When an associate finds out how difficult the task is, he'll often come running in trying to dump the monkey back on your desk and off of his back. Make sure the monkey is on his back when he walks out. However, he'll probably also inform you of genuine problems he's experienced in the system. If he's been encountering ropes, if he's been running into rocks in the roadway, it's your job to remove them as a supportive action. Eighth, a review of effective delegation would be to ask the following two questions. Have I delegated primarily the urgent items and kept for myself the important items? The urgent is seldom important, so delegate all the fires and crises that you can. And remember that the important is also seldom urgent. And that is why you need to get started on that KRA right away. The second question to ask yourself is, have I assigned people to problems more than I have to opportunities? Problems are usually associated with our current system, which is not going to be around in 5 years. Opportunities, on the other hand, represent the future the manager must spend time building. Superstar associates and their managers should focus on the opportunity work. Let the bench players in your department work on the problems. Delegation is just one way to help your people develop. It's just one part of how you can approach the people you need to be effective. Let me refer you to a simple study originally done by Daniel Katz a number of years ago. In this study, he identified some of the job behaviors he saw in men and women supervising effective work groups. He wanted to know, what is it that leaders do to get a high-producing group of people? In this study at Prudential Life Insurance Company, 36 claim processing groups with 720 employees and 36 supervisors were analyzed. These groups were matched by the researchers in terms of group size, sex, educational level, salary grades, the distance the workers had to drive home, personality profiles, age distributions, and all the other demographic variables you could imagine. They noted that some groups, similar in all respects to others, process claims much more efficiently. Now, claims units in an insurance company are like a factory assembly line. There are thousands and thousands of papers to be processed, with decisions being made on a case-by-case basis. The research question was, do the behaviors, the attitudes, the values of supervisors of high-producing units differ from those units that are less effective? What is it in the manager's approach to people that accounted for the difference in productivity and quality? Several characteristics emerged, and they are illustrative of a large number of other research studies being done on supervisory styles and their impact on work groups. It was found that leaders in the more productive units provided general rather than tight supervision. By that, I mean that these supervisors would tell people what they wanted and give a rough outline of what they had in mind, but otherwise didn't give a lot of details. Tight supervision was characteristic among units with low production. It was found that ineffective supervisors tended to go overboard in giving detailed instructions. They seemed to be operating under the assumption that the employee couldn't handle the job unless he or she was told exactly how it was to be done in every respect. Winners, on the other hand, tended to say, "Here's what I need you to do. Here's a couple of ideas," and then throw the problem to Harry, who had to go out and figure out how to do it on his own. An interesting corollary to this practice was that effective supervisors tended to give fewer instructions. The study didn't, of course, cover the new employees who knew nothing. In this case, the most effective supervisors tended to give a lot of educational time. For other workers, though, the reduced attention wasn't because supervisors weren't willing to give it. Rather, in general, they tended to provide less instruction to those employees who had been on a payroll for some period. They seemed to make a basic assumption about their people. The assumption was that this is a person with a brain. This is a person who's a pro. This is a person who may not come up with the same answer I'd come up with, but it's an answer that I can live with. General George Patton put it this way: never tell a man how to do his job. Tell him what it is you want him to accomplish and get out of his way. His ingenuity will amaze you. That seems to be the basic thrust of management by objectives. Tell the person what it is you want him to do. Tell him what the expected end result is, and then let him be creative. Another curious finding about effective managers is that while they don't give a lot of instructions and supervision, they actually spend more time on the shop floor with their employees. It was found that 75% of the winning supervisors spent about 50% of their time or more in direct supervisory contact. Time utilization among the losers showed that only about 33% of them spent as much as half of their time in direct people contact. In other words, the picture of the winning supervisor is that he or she is out of his office, on the shop floor, spending a lot of time interrelating, talking with people. 3/4 of them spend at least half of their time that way every day. The loser, on the other hand, is spending a lot of time in the office doing God knows what, but not working directly with the people as such. When he or she does go out on the shop floor, it's a lot of nitty-gritty instruction and tight supervision. The puzzling question was, what are those winning people talking to their employees about if they're not giving them supervision and instruction? The researchers found there was a lot of talk about wife and kids. There were a lot of fish stories and discussion of who went where on vacation. There was a lot of what some supervisors would label lost time or wasted time. Joking, compliment giving, general discussion of the news of the day, a lot of building of relationships, as well as listening to employee ideas and suggestions. Having built that relationship very carefully, the effective supervisor actually created in that work unit a kind of calming influence, a sense that this is a supervisor who is not out of touch with us. This is a supervisor the employees described as a simple human being, like I am. In fact, the researchers said that the effective supervisors tended to talk with people rather than talking to people. All this may at first suggest a very warm, considerate, in-touch human being, but in fact, the winning supervisor tended to be tougher and gave fewer recommendations for promotions and salary increases than did the losing supervisor. The loser in management tended to operate this way. When approached for a promotion or a salary increase, he or she tended to say, I'll see what I can do for you. And then they'd run down the hall and ask an executive to make a decision. The decision would come back, usually negative, because the executive would know that the unit wasn't producing. So the supervisor of that losing unit then went back to the employee and said, I tried to get it for you, but it didn't fly. At that point, the employee is aware that his boss has about as much pull in the organization as a marshmallow. The supervisor in a winning unit was the one who responded to a request for promotion or salary increase by saying, Hey, I'm not taking that down the hall. I'm not going to ask for approval for that. You and I both know you're not cutting it. I'm not satisfied that you've done what's required here. When you have, I will. And sure enough, when production met requirements, this supervisor was very quick to go down the hall to get the promotion or increase. Interestingly enough, he was also able to get a much higher percentage of those requests approved from higher management. The winner was able to confront her own management. When management response was, I don't think we can afford this, Liz, she was inclined to shut the door and say, Look, these people have really been producing. They've really been putting it on the line for me. This is a case where it's justified, and I want you to review this thing again. They would do anything except take no for an answer. Not only were they more quick to fight for their people when it really counted, but winning supervisors also tended to be more critical of company policy. How critical are you of company policy, and where are you critical? It was found that losers in management tend to have a lot of complaints and gripes about company policy, and they tend to voice those gripes in front of employees. The pro, on the other hand, the effective manager, was the one who was supportive of company policy even when he or she didn't like it personally. This leader would then go down the hall, shut the door with the executives, and in that executive office say, This thing has got to be changed. It's an amazing characteristic, and certainly tells a lot about what's happening in the overall dynamics in that work unit. In free discussion, when the researchers were just chatting with supervisors over coffee, it was found that less effective supervisors spent a great deal of time talking about the work that wasn't happening, the missed deadlines, the overload, the budget restrictions. The talk concerned the work itself. That contrasted markedly with effective supervisors, who in free discussion with the researchers were found to talk primarily about their employees. You know, Mary has really been having a hard time at home. She and her husband haven't been getting along very well. Don't know if the marriage is going to survive. We've been doing everything to try to help the work here. We've adjusted some work schedules, things like that. I sure hope Mary can handle it. She's just one of the great people. If we can help her through this period of time, I know she's going to come back and be fabulous again. The distinction here is the effective supervisor understands you don't worry about the work. Instead, you worry about the people who do the work. If you can help them get their problems resolved, if you can support those people, help them, be forgiving of them, those people are going to remember it. They're going to remember you. And then when they attack that work, they're going to attack it for you. They'll never attack it for the company. Who cares about the company? They'll attack it only for you. One last behavior was particularly revealing of underlying attitudes in this organization study. There were two cafeterias, an employee cafeteria and an executive dining room. For the insecure and less effective manager, it was very important to be seen in the executive dining room. He would go with his little suit coat on and be very careful about where he sat. He thought that somehow he was forging the right political connections that would be the secret to success back in his own operation. But where did the effective leaders eat? I suspect you would have eaten where they did, with the employees in the cafeteria. They made no big deal of status. They minimized any appearance of separation. They didn't wear the suit coat in the office. They looked and talked like one of the folks. Effective supervisors, effective managers, build on the strengths of people and provide leadership through that close-to-the-people behavior.